go ahead and get started. Welcome to our Fall Visiting Writer event. We want to thank the Donald Beacon and the School of Arts and Letters for financially supporting this. And we're very lucky to have Allison DeCamp with us today, all the way from Harbor Springs. Allison is an award-winning author of two middle-grade novels, My Near-Death Adventures, 99% True, and My Near-Death Adventures, I Almost Died, Mr. Lynn, which are fun to say. They're published by Ravenhoff and Crown. The first book in the series won the Michigan Notable Book Award. And like Sam, the hero of these books, Allison DeCamp grew up in UC. She's a graduate of Michigan State University, and she's a former middle and high school language arts teacher. And today she's going to talk to us about writing the middle grade novel, Big Questions for Young Audiences. So let's give her a round of applause.
Am I supposed to be at this podium? Okay. Oh, no. I just noticed the podium, and I thought, oh, maybe I'm supposed to be there. So, hi. Are you writers, right? And English education majors? Okay, me too. That's exactly what I did and what I was. I took one creative writing class and at Michigan State, and I wrote a satire, and when I got the paper back, the teacher had written on it, "This is screaming to be a satire." So that didn't go over too well, because that's what I thought I had written. So so I've had experience in both. And what I'm going to talk to you about today is my experience as a writer, as a reader, as a continuing writer, because you never get, unfortunately, to that point where you feel like, I got this. It's like golf to me. I hate golf. Because if you've ever golfed, I suck at golf. But every once in a while you hit that shot and it is so beautiful and you're like, I got this. I can golf. And then you never do that again. So that is where writing is as well. So this is my first book, which was published in February of 2015. I wrote it in 2013. That's publishing. That's how long it takes. It is about this young man here, Stan Slater, who is based on my great uncle, who spent time as a little tiny baby in a lumber camp in Germfask, which is, what, an hour from here or so? East, west. And that is where the basis comes from. Everything else is a lie. I use names from my history. We all have family history that we can use for our own fiction. And if you are teaching, same type of thing, to tap into that with your students, what their family history is and how you can manipulate it and use it. This is about a boy who has suddenly found out that his dearly departed father is actually not dearly departed. He's simply long lost. And he's not terribly loved by the women in his family. So he is also informed that he's going to be spending the winter of 1895 in a lumber camp, and he decides, what a great place to find my dad. So that's the premise there. He also likes to prove his manliness, which is non-existent. And he is constantly harangued by his older cousin, Jerry, who is very, very smart, is slightly older than he is, but acts a whole lot smarter, and she wants to be a doctor. So she's constantly diagnosing him with weird 19th century diseases like dropsy and effluvia, and he always thinks he's dying. So that's part of it, too. And then the second one, which just came out in July, is called My Near-Death Adventures, I Almost Died Again. Same guy. Now he's in St. Ignace. He is in charge of watching 7-year-old Cuddy Carlisle III because Stan accidentally broke his mother's leg. It's a total accident. And his cousin Jerry shows up again. This time she is very sick, and he's going to find a way to cure her and make a lot of money in the process. So everybody in their writing, I am going to be 51 years old next year. Nobody cares how old you are in publishing, as long as you do it well. And we all have our own journey. So there's this story from This American Life. Do you ever listen to that on public radio? And Ira Glass says to a room of people, He's the host, if you aren't familiar. How many of you are on plan A for life, for your life? And in this entire auditorium, one person raises her hand. She's 24. Everybody else is on plan B or plan C or plan D or plan F or X. Who knows? But my plan was always to be a writer, but I kept that so close to my chest that when I got my book deal in 2013, my husband, to whom I have been married almost 23 years, did not know that was a dream of mine. So this is my journey. It's not straightforward. It never is. And if it is, usually those authors tend to be jerks. And I know this because I work at a bookstore and we get a lot of, like, gossip about, and I've run into some of them too. This is me in fifth grade, and like some of you, you may have been writing your whole entire lives. So this is me, fifth grade. This is my favorite sweater. I think I really need it. If you look closely, I probably should have brushed my teeth better. But this was my first piece of published work. And I sent a letter, and it's actually my first opportunity of being edited as well. I sent a really great, and I'm sure very long letter to Cricket Magazine, my favorite magazine. And they published, I'm going to use the laser pointer, just this little bit. Now look, they published her entire letter. They published her entire letter. I got a few lines in the letterbox. And these are the ones they chose. I love horses and all kinds of animals. I'm going to be a farmer, an artist, a vet, and a football player when I grow up. I was a huge fan of the Pittsburgh Steelers. When I have my farm, I'm even going to have a deodorant skunk. Allison Ruig, age 10, St. Ignace, Michigan. So this is my first published work, and I have never been so excited in my entire life until I got my next published work 40 years later. At this time, wrote all sorts of things. I wrote large print books. Can you see this in the back row? Yeah. So could my grandma, who couldn't see very well, and so I wrote really bad large print books for her, and bless her heart, this was a woman who loved to read and was super smart and had a subscription to the Book of the Month Club, even though she didn't have much money whatsoever. And this is what she had to pretend to love to read, was my large print book that is about a character named Fred French Fry Frog. But I also, I wrote very sexist materials as well. This is called Old King Harris and the Three Trolls. And this was about, now you have to remember the time period too. So this was Old King Harris. He had a troll problem. So he told his kingdom, I will give anybody in my kingdom, any of you men, half my kingdom if you get rid of these trolls. But that's not all. I'll also give you one of my daughters. So yeah, what a deal. What was I thinking? And I wrote about commercials coming to life in this book, which is The Great Gertrude and the Great Commercial Mix-Up. I got really good at making covers, too, which was part of the fun. Yeah, because I should show you the cover of the other one, which is an old stationery box of my mother's that obviously was lighthouses, if you can't see that, which has nothing to do with Old King Harris and the Three Trolls. And remember, I was a huge Pittsburgh Steelers fan, so I wrote letters. I wrote letters to the Pittsburgh Steelers, and I told them I loved them, and I loved especially Mean Joe Green, who was number 75. I had his jersey, and I had the waste paper basket, and I had the mittens, and I had the coat, and I had the hat, and the slippers, and the scarf, and anything else Pittsburgh Steelers you could have. So instead of getting the football that I wanted autographed, I got autographed pictures from Lynn Swann and Terry Bradshaw, which are worth millions of dollars today. They aren't worth anything. And then I went to Michigan, because I looked on eBay, and they aren't, because I would have sold them. I went to Michigan State. I packed my 4 years into six and ended up becoming a very enthusiastic language arts teacher in Pellston. See how excited I am? This is a picture of a former student posted of me on Facebook, which was nice of her. And then I had a couple kids who are now 19 and 18. And I also, for a long time, and this is part of my journey, and I'm just telling you this because I didn't write that whole entire time. I did little things, like I had a blog with a friend, and so I wrote that. I made jewelry. I made glass beads and jewelry that I sold at a local art gallery and on Etsy. And I would write little descriptions of those, which I made more creative than I needed to, and didn't help me sell anything. But that was my writing and my creativity. Whoops. And I also, in 2008, was a dog walker. Actually, that was 2009, which is the most frustrating job on the planet. I thought it would be really fun. Because, right, you're walking dogs. Except you're walking the dogs that people don't want to walk. That's why they dropped them off for you to walk. And they're the ones who pull, and they... I had these two corgis who I swear were just messing with my mind because they were awful. So I did that, and then I applied. I was home. I was a stay-at-home mom. I love Dwight. It meaning I can't stand Dwight, but I love him because of that. I applied for a job, again, as a teacher, and like Dwight in this picture, I did not get it. And I was devastated, just like that. I was, because I was sure I got it. I was so sure. I'm only telling you guys this, oh, and actually anybody on this podcast who listens, I was so sure I got it. I was, like, devastated because I wasn't ready to go back to work. And any of you who have been teachers or taught, you know that it's not the time in the classroom. It's the time outside of the classroom that takes so much time to prepare and do a good job. And I was like, Sam, this is my husband, I know I'm going to get it. And then when I didn't, I was even more devastated. So that, though, in the back of my mind, planted this little idea, and I'm like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to show them. I'm going to write a book, and I'm going to get it published, which I've done, and it really hasn't changed anything because no one at that school is like, whoa, we should have hired her. So, but it worked. So what I want you to remember most of all is these are the questions that you constantly have to be asking yourself. And this is whether you are teaching writing or you are writing yourself, which you should be doing both if you're teaching writing. What if? Constantly ask yourself that. At every juncture of your writing, what if? Come up with the weirdest things you can come up with, the strangest things, the most bizarre things. And I wonder, and if only. And Neil Gaiman, I am not... Some of you probably are very big Neil Gaiman fans. I'm not a huge Neil Gaiman fan. I appreciate Neil Gaiman. But I do understand what I also think he could write something on a napkin and it would get published, right? But he said you get ideas from daydreaming, you get ideas from being bored, which is hard right now when I have my phone everywhere with me. You get ideas all the time. And here's your job, though. You have to notice those ideas. If you are teaching, you have to point out to kids so that they start recognizing their ideas. If you have a critique partner that you're working with, a writing partner, where you have ideas that you bounce off of each other, you point out ideas to each other. That's not cheating. That's what you do. That's what writers do. Ideas are alive. If you haven't read Big Magic by Elizabeth Gilbert, Elizabeth Gilbert's kind of out there. She truly believes that ideas are alive, like literally, and that she once conveyed an idea to a fellow author, Ann Patchett, through a kiss on her cheek. And she 100% believes that happened. I do think ideas are alive. I think you have to write them down. You have to cultivate them. You have to plant them, or else they aren't going to grow. They're going to say, if you took a seed and you threw it on your counter, it's not going to grow. Same thing with your ideas. Cultivate them. Allow them to change. Don't get so caught up in your own ego that you can't allow them to change. This was my idea. This is my great-grandmother, Cora Nelson. I never knew her. She died in the 40s. She still scares me to death. Look at her. Doesn't she look mean? This is the only picture I've ever seen of her. My mother actually loved her, but she in this picture she was probably like what, 40? I mean, that's how people looked back then, didn't they? They were like really young and looked super old, and had a hard life. But this is a family picture. I have this laser. I might go a little crazy with this. This is her. This is my Uncle Stan, who the story is based on, but obviously not when he was a baby. That's something I changed. This is my grandmother, Alice. My grandmother was 15 when her mother made her get married to Arthur Slater. And she was 16 when she had my Uncle Stan. Now, these are family stories I've heard my whole entire life that I have manipulated and changed but used. And you all have those. We all have those stories. You don't have to tell them verbatim. You can. That's the magic. I mean, that's the closest you get to being God, is by writing those things. So she made her get married, and then the dad, Arthur Slater, went out west and was working on the railroads, and he was not around. So they had to go to lumber camps and work. And I started thinking, oh, I wonder what it would have been like to be a young boy in a lumber camp in the 1800s. And that's basically where I started. And you also know, any of you as writers, that when you start, it's bad. Every single time, it's bad. I don't care who you are. You're writing, and you have to do it. You have to just do that bad writing, because that good writing's not coming out otherwise. Also, we've got these things in our heads, and somewhere, have you ever done that where you've written something, you looked at it later, and you're like, wow, that came out of me. Well, that's the only way that you can find that, is by writing it. That's exciting. The rest of it is not. It is really hard. So I'm going to just show you. I'm throwing myself out there. Here is the first thing I ever did with that idea. All right, I've got chapter one. This is like I thought was my outline. I don't care what you do, just get it on paper. Chapter one, Stanley travels to the lumber camp. I don't know the name of it. I don't know the company. Chapter two, and I can tell you this, 3 years later, I would never start a book like this now. But it worked then. You have to start where you are. Chapter two, they're going on a tour of the lumber camp before dinner. There's somebody in the back maybe who's sick. That was my thought initially. Chapter three, I have questions like, is there a mysterious man who shows up? These are just thoughts I'm having. Then this is my original chapter one, and I'm going to read part of it to you to show you how bad it is. And you don't have to be nice about it, because when I go to elementary schools, they're all always really nice. Like, oh, that's not bad. That's really good, because that's what they do. But it's not. It's bad. She scares me. That was the first chapter title. I knew the minute the words came out of my mouth that woman with the hook nose was going to leave a red mark somewhere on my body, but I just couldn't help it. Gee whiz, I muttered. I was talking to myself. Any sane person would understand and respect that. And when someone is talking to himself, even if it's out loud, he should be able to say whatever things he'd like. Plus, the bald eagle I saw earlier swooped back and flew so close to us in the sleigh, I thought it was going to take the cap right off my head. It is bad. It's embarrassingly bad. And what's worse is, actually, I thought that was good. I remember making my friend Kristen read it. And I'm like, what do you think? What do you think? And she was kind. But that was, it's not. There's nothing good about it. I also, and this is something that, when I listen to writers, I always try to take away things that I'm going to try. I don't use everything that every writer uses. I pick and choose. Some things work, some things don't. This works for me. I write an outline. This is my first outline. I use it as a roadmap. I also use it as a procrastination tool. So when I am in the middle of doing something and I don't know where I'm going, oh, I can make a pretty outline. And that gives me points. In the meantime, I'm still working. That is the cultivation of your idea. You can't, there is that story, right, that J.K. Rowling dreamt all seven of her books. Did have you ever heard that? And Stephanie Meyer, she dreamt them all. And if that were true, I can tell you right now, I think that is true. But if it just was that easy, I have prayed, dear God, send me one of those dreams. Just one. That's all I need. And it has never happened. But what I pretty much am sure is left out of that story is that J.K. Rowling and Stephanie Meyer were working. They were writing. They were trying to figure out this whole story. And so when they went to bed at night, because I do this when I'm working on something, I wake up and I think about it. Their subconscious worked it out for them. So you have to keep working on it. It's not just going to pop into your head like you've never thought of writing this book before and then boom, there it is. That will not happen. I was working, and remember my first draft, how bad it was. Well, I kept working on it and working on it. And for me, it takes about 20,000 words to get the voice of a character. And voice, especially in middle grade, is huge. And I shouldn't say especially in middle grade. I think voice is very, very important. And I didn't realize that until I found it. So I was driving downstate. I wasn't driving because that would have been really dangerous, but I was riding downstate, and this scene popped into my head, and it is Stan finding his father in the lumber camp. Today I found my father. It was nude, so I had this legal pad, and I just started writing, and there are probably, I don't know, 7 pages of this. So I went up to him at lunch and told him, hey, Newt, and Newt, by the way, was named after Newt Newtson, who used to take tolls at the Mackinac Bridge, because that is a good name, isn't it? you are my father. He was so glad to see me that he choked on his baked beans. Or maybe he just had a lot of food in his mouth. Stan, he said, I just met you 2 weeks ago, yeah? I can't possibly be your da. I didn't even know what I was doing there, but he had an accent. This is the actual chapter 17. I didn't know where that scene was going to fit in. I didn't, but his voice finally sounded to me like Stan. That was his voice. And it is the same voice that's in this published final draft, final copy. At dinner, I find my father. It sure took long enough. First of all, I've been so busy these last 2 weeks beating Stinky Pete at Cap Cribbage every night, I've almost forgotten to look. So that's still that same voice. And then, I'm procrastinating again. Another outline. I might do 5 outlines. Both for procrastination reasons and because I really like office supplies, but also because it gives me a map. And my story changes. Your characters are alive. They take you in these directions you don't plan on going. And so this is a way for me to plot out ahead of time. Still working. I started thinking again, playing with ideas. That great-grandma, that really mean, nasty one, she had this scrapbook from the 1930s. And she didn't have much money whatsoever, but she could clip things out of magazines. And I used to love looking at it, because what's more indicative of like a time period than their old ads and old photographs? It's like, I was thinking about that. These are some of the first scrapbooks. This is one of my favorites because it really shows like how people thought about cigarettes back then. Of course, they didn't think they were bad for you. Here she is, too tired to go on. And then she smoked a Camel. Because, of course, if you're too tired to go on, you want to smoke something that's going to make your lungs full of cancer. So, yeah. And just some of these. This was my mom's favorite. It's a picture primer for perplexed parents. The girl who refused to have her hair combed and her face washed, which was me when I was that age. Still playing. What if? What if Stan kept a scrapbook? This is what I started thinking. And this is my first attempt. And you can see I haven't really changed anything. I haven't found the voice yet. Oops. I will get better. By the end of this, I will have this figured out. I have not changed the text, but I have started thinking about, okay, Stan keeps the scrapbook. I remember, like,
in Parade magazine that used to come in the, that would come in the Sunday paper, and I'd draw like pipes or mustaches on some of the things in there. And so I thought, well, Sam could do that. He could draw on me. So I'm playing with that. You can see now I've changed the beginning. Mama says no one can be 100% evil. And I'm still changing that in red. And I'm still coming up with ideas for things for his scrapbook. This I never used because I couldn't be sure it was public domain. And otherwise I'd have to pay for it, which is something I learned. It also has nothing to do with what's going on in the chapter, so that was probably a good reason not to include it. I also did a ton of research, and if that is your type of thing, historical kind of fiction, which I didn't think was mine, but doing research is actually a great way of getting content, of sparking your, interest and taking your story in a different direction. So I found out things about Chang and Ang, the original Siamese twins, who are now called conjoined twins. You're familiar with that. Anybody who's had a Guinness Book of World Records has seen this picture, right? They turned out to be incredibly wealthy after working in the circus for years and years and years. But really interesting, they show up in the book. This would have been a circus poster that would have shown up in town. This was an early asthma inhaler, maybe. But that is, I always thought that looked like a mustache. It's really like all the gunk coming out of his nostrils. And then a log jam, which I think is fascinating because there's a river under there, but also shows how dangerous that job of logging really was. Because they had to go in there and find the one log. Also, you can see people there, like right here, give you perspective. They had to move the one log that would get that entire river going again, which is super dangerous. Lonigans, which I didn't realize that loggers, the cooks, would follow the river drive down the river and live on these houseboats and cook on them to serve the meals, the river drakes, who throw the logs down the trail. For the river. And then dentistry back then, no anesthesia. I learned a lot about medical cures, some very interesting because Jerry, one of the main characters, wants to be a doctor. So I looked up all sorts of things to do with that and what they look like. Annie Oakley, just a hero. Plague masks, which are fascinating and creepy. Collusions for book two. You can see that, right? The old lady and the pretty woman. And Nellie Bly. Yeah. Oh, and coffin conventions, in case you got buried alive. So, those are all things I learned. The other thing you need to do, and you have to do, whatever, and this is, I'm going through everything I read, pretty much. You have to read. If you're going to be a writer, you have to read. If you're going to write for middle grade, you have to write that middle grade, read that middle grade genre. 8 to 12-year-olds. That's middle grade. Not middle school, but middle grade. And it's a really interesting time of life. I did not foresee myself as a middle grade author. If you'd asked me what kind of writer I wanted to be, I would have said adult fiction. But adult fiction, especially and YA fiction, scares me. Because there's so much that you have to deal with. Also, I could never write a memoir, because first of all, nothing really has ever happened to me. But secondly, because I would never want to hurt anybody in my family, and I restrict that. So these are some books that I have read that I love. Dory Phantasmagory, that's what it talks about. Oh, this is super creepy, which I don't like anything creepy. I'm a big chicken, but this is good. I'm thinking of Bending Things, which just came out this summer. Cody and the Mysteries of the Universe, which is a really good, that might be good for your daughter as well, like for sixth grade. Walk to the Moon, love that book. That makes me cry every time. Handmaid's Tale, awesome book, very frightening, but Margaret Atwood, of course. Freakonomics, I read things like that as well, which is just, or anything by Malcolm Gladwell,
I read Vanity Fair. I have this issue. I love Adele. I read the Daily Mail because I got to keep up on my celebrity gossip. I read cereal boxes because they have words on them. Big magic. If you are going to see a writer, read what other writers have to say about it. Big magic is the book I was telling you about where she kissed Ann Patchett and shared her idea. But it also is about creativity, whether, whatever it is, painting, ice skating, I mean, whatever your love is, she's really good about making you feel like you can do it. And that's what I want you to feel like, because you can. Stephen King. I don't read Stephen King because I'm a chicken, but you can read on writing because it's his memoir, and it's super good. He's a good writer, I mean, no matter how you look at it. But this one of the things I took away from him that I think was so good is that connection as a writer to your reader. There's like this invisible magic thread that he talks about, and I never thought of it before, but it's true. That the words you put on the page, when they get to that reader, you have formed a connection. And in this day and age, you know, if you'd ask me maybe, I sound like I'm 80 years old in this day and age, I don't mean that. And I'm not going to get political, mostly. I'm not. But if you'd asked me maybe 2 months ago, is what you do important? I would say, I don't know. It's not brain. I literally would say, I'm not curing cancer. And I believe that. And I'm not so tied to my words that I won't listen to other people. I know people like that, too, who are like, I can't change this part of my book because it's just part of me. And I'm not like that. But words are so important. Lack of censorship is so important. Empathy is so important. And you know what it's like to get caught up in that world of a book where you feel like you're experiencing it with the character so that you actually don't have to go in the Hunger Games. But you felt like you did. And you can understand and empathize and feel it's the most human way to feel. And that is important. So I'll get off my soapbox for that. But that is important. And when you write, that is important. It's important for you, too, to convey who you are. Sometimes you can't figure that out unless you write it down. Oh, and Save the Cat. Are you familiar with Save the Cat? So Save the Cat is done by Blake Snyder, and he's a screenwriter. And he has died, unfortunately. But he has this great book on screenwriting, so it lays out the plot points. And it's good for anybody for setting up plots. So he's great. And the whole title relates to the fact that there's this movie, I feel like it's with Dustin Hoffman, where that it gives us an example. Early on in your story, your main character has to have a save the cat moment. And that means that the example he used is this guy was setting up a sting operation to catch these criminals in New York City. And as they came in, they handcuff them and take them off. Well, this one guy came in and he had his son with him. And the cops said, the undercover cops said, oh, yeah, we're closed. So no matter what that cop did, he could have been dirty all the way through the rest of the book, but he had that moment where he saved the cat, like saving the cat from the tree, so that we as viewers or we as readers have some sympathy for him. So that's where that comes from. But look at it, you find a ton of that online on his blog, Blake Snyder. And then Elmore Leonard, I love these roles. I'm constantly going online trying to find that magic word that'll make this easy. Just anybody, tell me what makes it easy. He is so good. Never open a book with weather. Avoid prologues. And I will say that in anything, you will read prologues, but in anything that I have read from agents, who are the gatekeepers in this business, nobody wants a prologue. Never use a verb other than said to carry dialogue. I mean, you've probably heard a lot of this. Keep your exclamation points under control. You are allowed no more than 2 or 3 per 100,000 words in prose. And I rarely ever use exclamation marks. I used to, and I do in my emails, which makes me sound very excellent. I apologize usually, though. Makes me seem very excited. Never use the word suddenly or all hell broke loose. Use regional dialect patois sparingly. Avoid detailed descriptions of characters. Those any kind of details rather than showing a character and just telling about a character aren't effective. Don't go into great detail describing places and things. And this is my favorite, try to leave out the part that readers tend to skip. And, now I researched this. This is probably the most important thing. I only write, this is William Faulkner. This has been attributed to a lot of different authors, but when I researched it, William Faulkner seems to be the first one to say it. I only write when I feel the inspiration. Fortunately, inspiration strikes at 10 o'clock every day. You got to put your butt in a chair. It's just how it is. You have to actually write. Now, am I saying I always do that? No. But when I'm productive, yes, that's what I do. And then if you haven't gone through Pixar's 22 Rules of Storytelling, are you familiar with these? They're fantastic. They're so good. They have like things like, once upon a time there was blank, every day blank, one day blank, because of that blank, because of that blank, until finally blank. Putting it on paper only allows you to start fixing it. If a perfect idea stays in your head, you'll never share it with anyone. Keep in mind what's interesting to you as an audience, not what's fun to do as a writer. Those can be very different. So these are all really good. You can find these online, too. These are really good points of reference. And then I had just read an article again. I told you I was trying to find things that make this easy. I found this article about story genius. And this was a woman, Lisa Cron, who went through and found exactly what hooks readers. And is it beautiful prose? Is it dramatic plot? Is it sensory detail? Is it a unique protagonist? No. It's about how the things that happen in the plot force the protagonist to struggle with an unavoidable problem, thus triggering, scene by scene, a long-needed, incredibly hard internal change. Now, I just read an article on this. I haven't read the book. I would encourage me to read the book, but I just found out it was a book. So I just went through, she's got this online. I'm not going to go through it in detail because I haven't understood it wholeheartedly yet myself. And I'm always struggling with things like hooking a reader, what it is to hook a reader. Because it seems different in everything I read, unless it's a murder mystery, unless the consequence of someone's going to die, which can't be like every single book, it's hard to find a really clear hook sometimes. But she says, what is your point? I'll just go through these quickly. What is your protagonist's agenda? What does she enter wanting? No, I always think, what does my character want? What's going to get in the way of what she wants? What's going to happen if she doesn't get what she wants? What long-standing misbelief will your protagonist confront and overcome to get what she wants? And then there's all these external plot problems that force your protagonist. Make them really uncomfortable. Always make your protagonist uncomfortable. What will your protagonist's ultimate aha moment be? That's the climax of your story. And here's why at every turn. So I just read this article in the newest book I'm working on, which I've been working on for 3 years. This, just asking why. My character is obsessed with obituaries. And I knew that from the minute I started writing. But I didn't think until I read this article to ask why. So I'm still working that out. You also need to interact. These are all really good resources for finding an agent. And honestly, they don't care how old you are if you write a good story. Nobody cares. They don't care what you look like. They don't care how you act outside. Well, they might. if you're on Twitter a lot and you offend a lot of people. But, so we've got SCBWI. Are you familiar with them? That's a society. If you are a children's writer, that's a society for book, children's book writers and illustrators. They have conferences, fantastic conferences, where you can interact with other children's writers. Absolute Right is a great forum for you to interconnect or to connect with other writers. NaNoWriMo, familiar with that? So National Novel Writers Month, which is right now, where you write a novel. This is one of the reasons I write middle grade. Middle grade is usually like 30 to 50,000 words. So my novel is a lot shorter than if you're writing adult, which is 80, 90, 100,000. I can write two books. but that's going on right now. Really good way to motivate. I wrote my third book during NaNo in 2013. I'm still working on it, but I got that first draft done. If you are looking for an agent, which is the gatekeeper to traditional publishing, then you need to check out Agent Query Connect, but it also is a good way to connect with other writers, to find a critique partner who's not your mother, who will not tell you, oh, this is so great, because that doesn't help you whatsoever. And Twitter, if you like Twitter. I hate Twitter. Twitter makes me feel very uncomfortable and like I'm not funny. So that's not a good combo. And this month, or this year again, for children's writers again, WriteOnCon is an online conference. Agents show up there. A lot of other authors will take part in that. Really good way to network. Another thing is, as an English education major, those are also good ways to connect with writers, published writers that will you can bring into your classroom. A lot of them do a lot of work in the classroom or on free Skype visits, which is also exciting. You also need to live, because that's where you get your experience. So you should go do whatever it is these people are doing and go outside, make a snowman, walk with your friends, go travel, have an attractive family, sit on a park bench, all those things. Then you're going to continue playing with your ideas. This is me still playing, but I've got a different beginning now. I don't have a chapter title. I've got a voice. I've got different illustrations. A lot of these show up. I've got all these words that I overuse. I forget what that command is on the map, but there's a command that shows you how many times you use certain words. Maybe it's F5. Looks like it. And I just have ideas that I'm working with here. Remember, we also have to know this idea. That's part of our job as writers and part of our job as teachers, to help people know their ideas. This is my third book. I saw this image on Facebook, on a friend's page, 3 years ago, and I thought it was, that's a fly. And here's somebody who set up this kind of art installation of this tiny shrine. And I came up with a title, and that's all I had. And it was called Tiny Shrines for Dead Flies. And that has never changed. And that is the book that I wrote during NaNo, and that is the one I'm editing right now, and that is the one that is driving me absolutely crazy. But I noticed that idea. I'm convinced that that title alone made my editor give me a 3-book deal rather than just one. So do that. Notice those things. Those things, those weird things that could be an idea. And then just know that that's true. Writing is super hard. I mean, it's not like getting over some brain illness hard, but it is hard. If you want to do it well, you have to let go of your ego, for one thing. And you have to just keep writing. So, if you are thinking of becoming a traditionally published author, you have to query. Are you familiar with that? So you send out, it used to be when I first started sending things out, which was a long, long time ago, you could just send a self-addressed stamped envelope and your manuscript to an editor. That does not happen so much anymore. I think it probably could to some extent, But for the most part, you need to find an agent. And agents are really picky. They have to believe in you and your work and your future. They only take on a certain number. My agent is a children's agent. She has sold some adults, and she's willing to take that on, but she's mainly children. And she is, she gets about 10,000 query letters a year. Your agent probably gets a ton as well. So you have to know what you're doing. You do not do this haphazardly. Check out querysharp.blogspot.com. Lots of examples of good queries and bad ones. Query Tracker was my Bible. I went on that. I still go on that thing. I have an agent. I still go on there just because I'm curious sometimes about what's going on in the world of agents and queries. This is a really good way to keep track of what agents want. And if they're getting back to people on a timely fashion, if people just, it's a good forum, too, to get connected. And if Mindy McGinnis, who's a YA writer, but also has been a school librarian, she will do a Saturday class which will take apart your query and help you make it better. And then manuscript wish list is a hashtag on Twitter that you can check out, and agents and editors will write down or will tweet what they're looking for manuscripts. This is my query. And a query is very, very similar, especially for the first book, to the back of the book. Mine isn't so much, but especially adult and young adult, sometimes they just take the query and change it a bit. So that'll give you an idea. But you start off, this is how they always are. They're about five paragraphs, they're one page. You research your agent, you see what they want. This agent wanted the manuscript sent, so I sent her, I think, maybe five pages she might have asked for, or 50. Whatever they asked for, that's what you send, but otherwise you look like you don't know what you're doing. And concepts, especially for children's publishing, are very prevalent and a really good way to A, network, and B, find an agent. So there is the VCFA, which is the Vermont College of Fine Arts, which is a very good young adult and children's fine arts program. It's a low-res master's program for YA, middle grade, and picture book. PitMat and Pitch Wars. PitMat is obviously on Twitter, but check out Brenda Drake's blog. She's a really big proponent of children's literature, and she has these contests that pair you up with agents and published authors. Query Combat and Sun vs. Snow is another one on Twitter that come up throughout the year. Brenda Drake, I know, has her calendar up online, so you can check and see when that's going to be. I got an agent, Sarah Davies. She's in England. She was in Virginia, but she's English, so she moved back there. She's super scary. She's like Mary Poppins, but like meaner. And very editorial, which is something I wanted. So she loved my book, and she wanted to work with me, and she wanted to sell it. And she loved it, remember? So she sent me back three pages that looked like this of what I needed to change. So we spent 4 months on that, changing, revising, rewriting the whole entire thing, doubling the size of the text. And I sold, and at the time when I was querying, my book was called The Somewhat Manly Scrapbook of Lover Stan Sigwood's Adventure. Which, this book would have been this wide, right? Just the title. So, she changed it when she pitched it to The Stupendous Scrapbook of Somewhat Manly Stan. And, obviously, then it changed to My Near-Death Adventures. 99%. This is what the inside looked like when I came up with, I had signed all of the almost 200 illustrations. So when I came up with them, this is what it looked like, and I sent them that. This is what it looks like when my publisher put it together, which is so much better and something I never could have done. And then what happens is kind of the fun part. The illustrator sent me a picture of Stan. And he said, well, what do you think? Now, I will tell you, I love this picture of Sam now, but when I first saw it, I'm like, he'd be a lot skinnier. He would never be able to pick up that axe without hurting himself, and his shirt would be bigger, and his hair wouldn't be so reddish. And so my publisher's like, oh, yeah, we'll let him know. And then they sent me covers. What do you think of this one? So we went through all the covers. I went with all my friends, and we looked at them, and we, oh, what do we think of the covers? Oh, what will it be? And I'm like, well, I really like the blue one. So, of course, this is the one I ended up with. So you get, in traditional publishing, really no say. And then for writing for a middle grade audience, you need to know anytime you're writing who your audience is. I have just had people say to me, oh, you know what, I accidentally and I want to send it off to a publisher. And I'm like, I kindly dissuade them, but I'm thinking you don't accidentally write a picture book. That's not an accident. You have to be intentional for anything. So know your audience. So be clear, whatever it is. Middle grade, 8 to 12, 3rd to 7th grade, typically. I mean, we've all read Harry Potter, so that kind of transcends that, but that's an anomaly. Middle grade readers tend to read up to an 8-year-old, read about a 9-10-year-old. Just keep that of really creepy. So, parents or anyone preaching at you, what do? You just numb out, right? That's what they think. So, I've had well-meaning teachers and in-laws and people say to me, oh, I have a great book about, let's say, bullying. Well, if you're going to preach to these kids about how bad bullying is, that doesn't work. If you're going to write a book like Wonder, where kids feel like they are the kid who could be bullied, that's totally different. So you don't want to preach, you don't want to be didactic, where you feel like you're teaching a lesson, because we all hate that too. Generally, 30,000 to 50,000 words. Restrictions. There aren't so much in YA. People are a little more lenient, but in middle grade, you have to watch what you put in there. Really, they don't like swearing. They don't like, and it's not, well, we all know, like, kids are to swear, but parents don't like that, and you have gatekeepers. Minimal self-reflection. Middle graders are not, like, sitting back navel-gazing. They just aren't. Middle grade books are most often bought by gatekeepers, so you have to please as a writer, librarians, teachers, and parents. That's who you're appealing to. And also, kids are not afraid of the big questions. They have them. So don't water down your message. They get it. This last book that I'm writing, or the book that I'm writing now, has to do with death. It's a girl, obviously, she's obsessed with obituaries. She lives in a funeral home. I try to inject humor because I think death is really scary. I think being human is hard. And if you can make a little bit of humor, it diffuses things for kids. If you can empathize with a character, it makes them feel not so alone. I mean, we've all been there. So don't shy away from big issues, but also, yeah, just don't shy away from big issues. Just leave it at that. And then I just heard from my agent, social media, as much as we hate to hear it, editors like to see a social media platform. So choose one or two. If Instagram's great for middle grade, they can access that. I have a Facebook page. And I have Twitter, too. I will look at all those things. But I'm most comfortable probably on Facebook. And then I try to do Instagram. And I do not understand Snapchat for the life of me. But publishers do have a social media platform. So just keep that in mind. And then I also have coming in 2017, I'm part of an anthology called Funny Girl, which is all women writers writing humorous stories for middle grade girls. I barely gave you a chance to breathe.
None? I have answered all of your questions. Right? Yes.
So, you were talking about things that should not go in the book.
Mm-hmm.
How would you couch that if someone was asking you about censorship? So, is that self-censorship? Are there times that you really wish that you could use some of those phrases, concepts, whatever you're trying to avoid? I'd love to hear your thoughts.
That's a good question. So recently, relatively recently, Shannon Messner, who's a very well-known middle grade author, was asked to attend. It's just tons of school visits. So she was asked to go to a school. She was getting paid to do it. Part of her job. And again, she's a well-known author. They asked her, they disinvited her because one of her characters has a brother who is a heroin addict. And they weren't comfortable with that. Now, kids live with that. There are kids who deal with that. And so that I have a real problem with. I have a real problem with this woman, Rainbow Rowell, who wrote Eleanor and Park, which has profanity, but none of it's gratuitous. It has a beautiful story that left me feeling, as an adult, more empathetic than before I read it. And it's just a good story. She got asked to go to Minnesota to some schools there, and they disinvited her because of censorship, because there was swearing. There were certain parents who didn't like the swearing in the book. Now, what would you rather have? Your kids read this and feel more kinder and more empathetic to other kids who may be struggling, and a few swear words? Or they just throw the baby out with the bathwater. I also work in a bookstore, and when parents come in, I will say, do you have content? Content. Of course, they don't. Like the Fault in Our Stars, anything by John Green has content. And a lot of parents are okay with that, but they aren't with swearing. They're okay with violence. So, if you want to write it and that is part of your story, do it. But if you are making that hill to die on when you can still get your message across without it, then I'd let it go. So my main character, imagine his father as this great heroic man. And he has him writing, he writes letters to himself, which is really pathetically sad. He writes letters to himself as if they're from his father, with pictures. And sometimes he's like this cowboy in Buffalo Bill's life. And other times he's an explorer. And in the original draft, I had one being an Indian chief. And my editor said, you cannot do that. She said, are you Native American? And I said, no, I'm not. And she said, then you cannot use any Native American images like that or refer to them. And at the time, I'm like, seriously? I mean, he's looking at this like a good thing, right? This is a heroic thing. He's not disparaging. She said, and she's right. So I let that go. Because there are Native American bloggers who would take huge offense at that. And that's just not worth it. She gets a message across. Anything else? Well, thank you. Oh, yes. Well, that's always a good question, isn't it? Like, we get so attached to certain parts. Yeah, you know what happened? So I had this minor character named Stinky Pete, because a lot of this is related to my family history. And I have Archibald Crutchley, who, as his name suggests, we don't like. Archibald Crutchley originally was going to be Mama's tutor and based on my grandfather, who was a lovely man by all accounts. Well,
Turns out Stinky Pete and Archibald Crutchley end up, my readers and my editor and my critique partners were like, oh, no, Mama's got to be the Stinky Pete. I'm like, no, he's not my grandpa. And I had to come to terms with that. They were right. But there are times in writing, too, where, you know, I got tons of rejection from agents. Tons. Where I literally banged my head against my kitchen table. I'm like, why am I doing this? And then, like, the next day I'd get something like, hey, could we see your whole manuscript? So that's part of it. It is a occupation filled with rejection. And those types of things you have to be able to digest. And if you really want that to be your thing, then choose it. But don't make it, like, bigger than it has to be. If it's good, that thing, that list, because if it's good, it'll show up somewhere else. If you can let it go, let it go. Any other questions? Well, thank you. Thank you so much for listening.